Let us say that again. Towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. And we open the palms of our hands and the sacred syllables. We breathe into the hand and we use that as a blessing of all the Master Saints and Prophets to move over and through our being. May they all be here with us to guide us and inspire us on this journey together for the next hour. I'd like to read a few words from last month's class, and I will refer back and forth to that class. I think it was an important one that can also be found online, as you know. So Murshid, Hazrat and Icon, says, exaltation, which is a greater bliss, a higher pleasure, and which makes us independent of the outer life for our happiness, does not seem to be known or understood by the majority. We know this is true. I mean, we are encouraged to live a very external life, material life, a life that's engaged in technology, a life that's engaged in commercialism, a life that's engaged in even competition. But this is a different kind of attitude. This is a more of a looking in. So again, he says that exaltation, it gives us a sense of independence from our outer life for our happiness, but that this again is not known by the majority. We're so lucky to have found each other and to have found this path and these teachings. He goes on to explain or ask the question, what is exaltation? Again, this is from last class. Murshid says, the soul can go through different experiences, which are all in reality, the longing of the soul. Now, last month, we talked about four different levels of that. And again, you can refer to the audio, video, and or the study guide from last month's class. He goes on to say, mistakenly, a person does not seek those experiences, but instead, again, the experiences that give a lasting happiness. He says, mistakenly, a person does not seek those experiences, but instead experiences something else. For instance, it is a constant yearning of the soul to experience happiness. The constant yearning of the soul to experience happiness. And instead of that, it becomes connected with that, what one calls pleasure. But pleasure belongs to sensation. I like the way someone touches me. I like the fragrance of something. I love that piece of cake or pie or that cookie. That is momentary. But pleasure belongs to sensation and happiness to exaltation, meaning elevating ourselves, our consciousness, again, beyond the material plane. In one of the prayers, the line, I think about it again and again in my own life. Raise us above, the prayer says, raise us above the denseness of the earth. And throughout the day, I often repeat to myself as a mantra, raise me above the denseness of the earth. It's very captivating. It's very seductive. And it's okay to play there, but we don't need to always live there. It's not a place of true happiness. He says, pleasure is only the suggestion and happiness is the reality. So here he's again making a distinction between happiness that may be stimulated by pleasure, pleasurable experiences, but happiness in a higher realm, as is exaltation, is beyond sensation, beyond outer stimulus. It's something that's lasting. It brings happiness in reality, in a big R sense. So that was from last month. This month, every soul yearns for knowledge. So while every soul yearns for happiness, it also yearns for knowledge. That knowledge, which will give exaltation. that knowledge which will give exaltation. It's a very interesting statement. But the soul cannot be satisfied. Again, I repeat, but the soul cannot be satisfied by the knowledge one gathers from books, by learning, or by the study of outside things. For instance, the knowledge of science, the knowledge of art are outside knowledge. They give one a kind of strength, a kind of satisfaction, but this does not last. Now, I want to pause here because I want to say a few words. I think all of you know that I've studied with a very prominent, had the blessing to sit at his feet and also at his dinner table. So the story relates to that, of a very prominent Tibetan Buddhist teacher. He's the tantric master, formerly. He passed away, but he's reincarnated again. He was the former tantric master to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a former minister of religion for the Tibetan government in exile. His name is His Eminence Kamtul Rinpoche. And I'll never forget, and this happened a number of times, it was very consistent. But it seemed that everything Rinpoche did, he did so purposefully. So I remember seeing him, and this was again on more than one occasion. He would get a piece of bread and he'd bring it before him and he'd look at it as if he was looking through it, or the bread, something about it was communicating a deeper knowledge to him. Everything, all of his motions were like this. When he held something, you know, it was so beautiful, and it was as if everything he was seeing was fresh and new to his eyes, or he was penetrating into it to get a deeper understanding. And so that is something I'll never forget, was especially noticing the delicacy of his hands, but also the way he'd stare at something so deeply and penetrating, as if every piece of food and every rock and every object and every statue and every person was speaking to him. So this is a kind of different way of gathering knowledge. And this can happen, for example, the one that studies art and practices art. That becomes a kind of concentration that can inform our being. It's almost like the mind gets put aside. We get engaged in the activity and something else emerges. Those that love gardening maybe have that through being involved in the earth or planting things and watching them grow. So that's not to say that the external world is of no use to us. It absolutely is. And we can be very informed by engagement with it. Back to Anayat Khan's words. So again, he says, for instance, the knowledge of science, the knowledge of art, and outside knowledge, they give a kind of strength, a kind of satisfaction, but it does not last. But if we can lift the veil and go deeper into it, that can be lasting. It is another knowledge that the soul is really seeking. The soul cannot be satisfied unless it finds that knowledge. And those of us on the spiritual path, we know many teaching stories about that. For example, for Rita Dinatar's The Conference of the Birds, Saint Teresa of Avila, The Interior Mansions, Saint John of the Cross, The Dark Night of the Soul, that there this thirst for knowledge perpetuates us through different levels of almost self-initiation, self-realization, the lifting of veils, so that we become more and more, maybe we could say wise, maybe we could say illuminated on the way to enlightenment. Back to Murshid's words. But that knowledge does not come. Okay, the soul cannot be satisfied unless it finds that knowledge. And then he goes on to say, but that knowledge does not come by learning names and forms. I mean, let's remember, Some of the greatest illuminated beings were illiterate. And yet there's millions of people that have followed their teachings over, centuries. So it's not about names and forms. It's about a deeper knowledge, a deeper realization. And believe me, I believe in education. I believe in knowledge. I think knowledge is freedom to a certain extent. So I'm not dismissing that. I mean, I'm an educator. I have the ultimate top degree I could have in my field. So I know that also there is a mastery that we accomplish through study and through doing and through practicing a craft. So please don't think I'm dismissing that, nor is Murshid. I mean, he was a great musician and he couldn't have gotten there without a lot of knowledge and study. So we're not saying it's either this or that, it's this and that. So again, but that knowledge does not come by learning names and forms. On the contrary, it comes from unlearning. Now, that's an interesting word. We hear it a lot. Be ye as little children, and unlearning, we hear that a lot in our teachings. But is it unlearning everything, or is it unlearning selfhood? Selfhood, I'm this, I'm that, you're this, you're that. Maybe it's a kind of unlearning to have a kind of innocence in our engagement. It sounds very easy, but I think it's quite a mastery it takes to unlearn. It's as if that's one of the reasons we do our purification breaths every day, because we have to cleanse the impressions from the mind. And so unlearning away is removing those impressions that almost like it's like looking at a cracked mirror where things are distorted or a broken glass. So we're just trying to get clarity. And sometimes unlearning helps us do that because it helps us shake ourselves free, maybe from attachments and the idea of likes and dislikes. Hazrat Anayat Khan says, "Do not be surprised, therefore, if you read in some books of the East that Mahatmas, the great learned teachers, went into the mountains and sat there for many years." I do not say, he says, I do not say we should follow their example, but we can appreciate what they've brought from there. They went there to explore life, that aspect of life which is unseen and remains unexplored. Not the outer life, the inner life. The inner life. They sat there for years in meditation. They lived on leaves and fruits on which they could find in the forest. They contemplated. What they have gathered is not knowledge learned from the world, a greater knowledge that can be learned from within. And this is again a theme that came from last month's class. The truth is within us. To thine own self be true. I remember I said about the gate at Delphi, know thyself and thou shalt know God. But who is thyself? It's thyself. Finding that connection. Perhaps I've told this story, and if I have, hopefully you're not yet tired of it and would be happy to listen again. When I was living in India at and doing work for the Jhamsa Sopa Foundation, and I was also teaching English at the monastery of my teacher, but also the Buddhist dialectic school established by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I didn't have a lot of time for retreat. And my Western friends that were there were going up. There was up the mountain, there was a retreat center called Tushita. And they were going for 1 month, 2 month, 3 month retreats. And I thought, and they kind of would jab at me a little bit, saying, "What are you doing here? You're so busy. You're always working. You're wasting your time. You should do retreat." And I asked Rinpoche about it, and he said, "No, this is good for you. The work is good for you. I'm a working yogi, so to speak. I think all of you know that already." But at any rate, he did decide that just for a short time, he wanted to send me to a place. It's known as Tso Pema. Tso means lake. Pema means lotus. It's the place where Padmasambhava Guru Rinpoche, who it is said was the second coming of the historical Buddha, he lived there. And the lake was created. The origins of the lake are mythical and mystical. It's said that the rulers of the kingdoms of the area became very jealous of Guru Rinpoche, and he had incredible powers, and he had incredible magnetism, and he had incredible beauty, and he had incredible skill, and people were drawn to him. And you know, throughout history, what happens. So anyway, it was so such was the case with Guru Rinpoche. He had a consort named in the area. Her name was Mandarava. So they tied Mandarava and Guru Rinpoche back to back, and in the middle of this land at the base of the mountains, they made a kind of lake of oil, and they lit it for them to burn. Well, they didn't burn. Guru Rinpoche transformed that oil into a beautiful lake. And what rose out of the lake, like simultaneously, it became water with these beautiful lotuses. And still to this day, that lake is there with beautiful lotuses burning. Sometimes, if you look up His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Tso Pema, you'll see him. He's there at that lake, touching the water and everything. Well, this is where Rinpoche told me to go. And there's a prayer, and I'm going to share it with you in a moment. But I'm telling you this because I want to get to the point. This isn't so much about me, although it might sound a bit biographical, but I apologize. It's kind of part of the journey. And it's also a way of saying that through work, we can also gain knowledge, not just through sitting in meditation. Although what I want to tell you what I witnessed there. So Rinpoche gave me what's called the seven limb prayer, and I'll say that in a moment. We can do that together. And then he said, I want you to recite this prayer again and again while you circumambulate, meaning that you're going in a clockwise direction around this lake. Now, the lake isn't huge, so that wasn't a big task for me. And then he said further, then I want you to walk up the mountain and I want you to visit the people that have been meditating there. So there were monks and nuns. And they had been in these caves because the whole mountainside was filled with caves. And he said, try not to disturb, but if they're open to it, ask them if they'll let you go in. And I want you to look for evidence of Guru Rinpoche there. So I have to say, you know, people were very warm. And, you know, of course, I used Rinpoche's name. That was a door opener. And they let me in. And I said, Guru Rinpoche, you know, some of them didn't speak English. And they showed me. It's unbelievable because, you know, these great beings can transform even the harshest material substances. So they take my hand and they put it like at the top of the cave. And there would be an impression of a hand there. There's no way to do it because this is not this wasn't a surface that somebody made. It's actual rock of the mountain. And then they'd say, and then like on the side of the wall, there'd be a footprint. And you know, it was fascinating. I get goosebumps when I think about it. But this was the evidence that Guru Rinpoche left there. And these meditators were so refined and joyful, and yet they hadn't had contact with people, you know, for 1 7 years, 1 13 years. So, you know, there was such a sublimity to have this alone time to pray and meditate and look at the deeper side of life. We don't have that opportunity in this life unless we go away to do that. And even then, it can be a big challenge. So I'm sharing this because even the atmosphere, when I looked out over the valley where the lake was, a cloud emerged I have to see if I can find that was way before digital anything. So it was a literal snapshot with paper. But I asked people, I said, do you see that cloud? I didn't give them any clue what I was seeing, but it was the exact, there's a certain pose that we see of Guru Rinpoche holding his implements and a seated position. And it was him. He manifested in the clouds above the lake. I mean, kind of extraordinary things can happen if we're open. And I'm ever grateful to those meditators for being kind enough to let me enter their sacred quarters to feel the atmosphere of their meditation and to witness with my own eyes and hands these experiences of Guru Rinpoche penetrating the stone just with his touch. Now, some of you as Sufis have, or even as Christians, perhaps, I know that they do this at Unity, for example, they do take silent retreat. It's good to do that. It's good to do that under the guidance of and direction of someone. My own experience doing that was, my mind is quite mercurial. You know that I move very quickly, and sometimes I can switch subjects quickly. What I noticed in the individual silent retreat was how that stream started to slow down, and there were gaps in between the thoughts. I could feel that. You know, it gives us a chance to look at our perpetual or even habitual thinking patterns. But then there start to become gaps, like when we're taught to meditate, the gaps in between the breath are as important as the inhalation and the exhalation. Because it's in the gap where we can touch a kind of consciousness, a stillness. And that teaches us how to go to that place of all happiness, peace, stillness. Even for a moment, it's like the ocean soothiness. So if you want to join me, it's okay. If you just want to observe, that's okay. But the seven limb prayers, palms pressed together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I make every type of offering actually offered and mentally transformed. I confess all my sins from beginningless time, and I rejoice in the virtuous deeds of ordinary and special beings. Please remain until samsara ends, turning the wheel of dharma, freeing all beings from samsaric cyclic existence. This I request and dedicate for the benefit of all sentient beings. Svaha. Seven limbs. We pray this for the whole world. The world needs love. The world needs forgiveness. The world needs understanding. Svaha. So be it. Amen. So, leading up, you'll see where I've been headed the whole way. I'd like for us to do this practice. It's a sacred name. We call it in Sufism. Wazaif or Wazifa in other traditions, we'd simply call it prayer. In other Eastern traditions, we might call it mantra. But I want to work with this practice, and this may be the first time as a group we're doing this. And this practice is called Shaheed. Excuse me, I'm trying to get my shawl there. Thank you. Shaheed means, O divine witness. So if you're not inclined to say Shaheed, you could just say, O divine witness, as we do this practice. But let's look into the meaning of Shaheed. Wow, this is so important and connects to this teaching. Shaheed is the omniscient witness, having complete and unlimited knowledge. We're searching for knowledge. Don't we want that? Complete and unlimited knowledge, not limited upon our experiences, but something greater than that. Shaheed is the one that directs and who directly and ever presently observes everything in creation. Witness. Shahid is the one who's from whose knowledge nothing's hidden. Everything is revealed. Everything's seen. Shahid witnesses both that which is seen and which is unseen. Shahid has knowledge of all that happens everywhere at all times. Al-Ghazali, some of you maybe have read some of his works, a great Sufi mystic, poet, author. He says, although some other Sufis are credited with this, but this is from Al-Ghazali, Sufism is based on experience and not premise. So it's not based on, again, necessarily a learning that's external to us. It's based on our experience. It's through our experience, observation and witnessing our experiences, analyzing them, meditating, concentrating, prayer, practice, that we can gain this knowledge. It's said that many ancient Sufi writers stressed the lifting of the veils. There's so many Sufis that have talked about this, the lifting of the veils. What are the veils? It's like as if the whole world is revealed to us. These new universe seems to become conscious. Everything, of course, is conscious. Are we experiencing it as such? Is it speaking to us? Murshid again says, there's one holy manuscript, the holy book of nature that can illuminate the reader. Everything's constantly singing its song, humming, giving praises to the beloved, to the divine being. Are we listening? Are we listening? May it be so. In Buddhism, it is often called removing the obscurations of the mind, obstacles to our clarity. And this is in Murshid's words now. Well, let's go back. Let's not go forward. Let's go back and let's do this practice. Okay. Let me check my time. Okay. We're going to give a short version of this, and we're going to do it just 33 times. But in your daily practice, you can do it 101, 34. Ya Shahid. Again, the D is emphasized. There's like a popping that kind of can happen with that. The sound code does something to our body if we allow it. There's a little stronger lingering on E. Ya Shahid. And then we move on and we'll just breathe in and out. Shahid. It will sound like this. And then we'll just on the breath, breathing in that divine witness, awakening the divine witness within. So let's give it a try. Ya Shahid. Ya Shahid. Ya Shahid. Ya Shahid. Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid, Ya Shahid. Just for a moment, for the benefit of others. Why do we say these words in this way? Why do we say Om? Why do we say Ya Shahid? Why do we say any of these words in their original language? Because as the nuns taught me, the same vibration of the words that Jesus spoke and all the great holy saints exist in the universe, and we are tuning to that vibration. We're trying to capture it and awaken it within us. So, of course, things like English is a very new language. A very new language, especially the way we speak it. And so, to tune into the vibration of these sacred sounds that have been whispered on the lips of beings over, well, literally thousands of years, there's a great power in that. There's a great tuning to it. It's like tuning the radio just to the right channel, to that right vibration. That's what we're doing. So now we're going to move to a whisper. And now just silently trying to feel that vibration within one's being, the great witness. As if every cell in your being is sipping in and enlivened with the divine witness. Yeah, Shahid. Nayak Khan goes on to say, one can see pictures of Buddha with closed eyes, sitting cross-legged. What does that symbol convey to us? If you have a museum near you, or even online, or if you have statues, really deeply contemplate that. When I lived in Kansas City, we had a beautiful collection of Asian art. And those of you that have gone to that museum with me, I often said, you know, I would put my hand like under the nose of the Buddha's head, and you could almost feel them breathing. Those statues were so alive. But there was subtle etheric quality to them, and such great peace, and such great vastness and openness. That art is a great art. It's very living. And so study them because they are teaching us something. And as Buddha says, as Hazarin Nayak Khan says, one can see pictures of Buddha with closed eyes, sitting cross-legged. What does the symbol convey to us? That there is a knowledge that can be learned by closing not only the eyes, but also the mind from the outside world. Again, turning within, tuning within. Closing the eyes does make the concentration any greater. Most people go as far as closing the eyes and no further. But if the eyes are closed and the mind is pondering over things, that's not concentration. So funny story, a friend of mine whose brother was a monk, lama, might have even been a Geshe, who's a very learned monk, went into a 3-year retreat alone, silent retreat in Tibet. And when he came out, he said, I have to go another 3 years. All I've thought about was building a house for my parents. So again, you know, we do that with our prayers, right? Sometimes we get, or driving, you know, we get, that's a kind of concentration. We get somewhere. It's like, how in the world did I get here? Or wait, I got to the end of that prayer. And did I really hear any of the words, or do I really know what I've been saying? So we know that from our own experience, and we can become better. I mean, we can just say, hey, this time I'll be better. It doesn't need to be a heavy thing, but it's a way to challenge ourselves deeper into concentration. So even though the eyes are closed, it still can be the little monkey mind in there. So anyway, those who can concentrate can do it without having to close their eyes. And those of you that are very deep in some activity, whether it's massaging someone or tending to a child or creating a piece of artwork or making a beautiful, meal or gardening or serving people in a hospital, whatever that may be, working on a computer, you know, helping with coding, whatever. Those things are also concentration. They can teach us really wonderful concentration. So use it and go deeply into it. So an icon tells the story. I once saw when traveling in the East, a person walking in a telegraph office. And however busy he was, his concentration continued. And I said, it's very wonderful that with all the work, you can go on concentrating. And the man, he says, looked up at him and smiled and said, "That is the way of concentration." Well, I bet you know, saints come in all kinds of guises. I think that person was a very wise person in that telegraph office myself. So Murshid says, let me put these down. I'm playing with my beads. I'm sorry if that noise is distracting. The sound that so Murshid goes on, and we're almost to the end, by the way. And then we can have some dialogue if you wish, question and answer. We still have a little ways to go. We're not bringing this flying carpet to earth just yet. So the next practice I'd like to talk about and us to do together is Ya Salaam. And we know that the meaning of this is, oh, divine peace. But what else does it mean? It means it's the source of peace, the flawless, the source of wholesomeness and our well-being. Wholesomeness and well-being. It's peaceful, of course. It's also quiet and tranquil and content and friendly and reconciled. Studying with Pir Vilayat, I heard it so many times from him. It's probably even in those little cards that were called alchemical wisdom. He says the path of spirituality is reconciling those things that are irreconcilable. Reconciling those things that are irreconcilable. Why do babies die? Why do good people get sick and suffer? Why is there war on earth? Et cetera, et cetera. But can we get a deeper perspective? What's God's viewpoint on that? Is it our limited judgment that doesn't allow us to see a greater purpose in all of it? Think about it. Reconciling the irreconcilable. Perhaps someone in your life has hurt you beyond anything that anyone could imagine. Can we find forgiveness? Can we reconcile that within our being and still have a kind of love? I'm not saying being a doormat. I'm not saying allowing someone to abuse you. I'm saying run as fast as you can from that kind of situation, but still within oneself, how does one reconcile it? And more than that, how does one forgive oneself? So reconciled, being friendly, tranquil, quiet, reconciling that which is irreconcilable. Salaam is to be free of imperfections, free from faults, complete, whole, sound. Well, I don't know about you. I have a long ways to go for that, to be free from imperfections and from faults. But what I do know, and I learned from my Rinpoche, it is those imperfections and those faults, if we're truly honest with ourselves, being true to oneself and thou shalt know God. Those are my little teaching points that God has given me to study and try to overcome, to try to gain mastery on, to try to become better. Those become the stepping stones to my enlightenment, to your enlightenment. We don't need to make excuses for him. It's like, aha, there you are, my friend. Let's see if we can polish that stone and use it to walk over to the next one. They become very good tools for us to evolve. Very good. So we don't have to feel, oh, I'm so imperfect. Why try? No, they're there for a reason. And we can come to a place, like it says, the flawless. Oh, wouldn't that be so lovely? Perhaps it's possible. Anything is. Anything's possible. Salaam is to feel safe. This is important, to feel safe, to feel secure in our being, to feel well, to feel healthy, and to feel prosperous. Those words mean certain things in a literal sense, but what do they mean in a spiritual sense? To feel safe in our own skin, to feel secure in our knowledge and where we're headed in our spiritual life and in our outward life. They mirror each other, you know, the spiritual and the material. To feel well, to have a sense of well-being, to feel healthy, even when the body's sick. Is there a healthiness to our attitude, to our outlook. There can be health in that. And to be prosperous, the way to do that is to not need every little shiny thing that comes your way, to give a little to others, to help others when you can. That makes us feel prosperous. It also, to feel prosperous, to be content with not having to have so much, but to appreciate what we have. You know, Karunaji, my friend that was one of the trustees of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, she said she remembers when the mother, one of the great saints of that ashram was alive. And she said, you know, when ashramites came to live there, they were given everything they needed. So they had bedding, they had some clothing if they needed it, they had a comb, they had a scissor, they had a toothbrush, they had toothpaste, bars of soap. So they're kind of, their material needs were met. But if one of them came to mother with those broken scissors, she'd ask them, "What did you do with those scissors? What did you use them for? Did you use them for the purpose that they were intended?" And if they weren't, she said, "Then you're going to have to work and get your own money to replace those." And you know, it's so true. We have to be mindful of those things. That way we can become prosperous. But if we misuse things, we become unprosperous. Is that a word? I don't know. But let's think about that. You know, there's another story. One of the relatives of Mahatma Gandhi, it might have been his grandson. I think some of you also in Kansas City, I know at the college, we met some of his relatives, and there was this story that they told. I'm pretty sure it was through one of them. It could have been a story I heard in India when I visited, where he lived in his last days, but he had a pencil that his Gandhi's grandfather had given him. And the pencil got very, very small because he had kept using it and using it and shaving and shaving. Maybe it was the grandson of Gandhi talking about this experience. And he said he wanted a new pencil. So even though it was still small and could be usable, he threw it in the bushes. And he said, "I need a new pencil." And the grandfather said, "Bring me the old pencil. Where is it?" And he didn't know what to do. He said, "You're not getting a new pencil till you bring me that old pencil." It's that kind of mentality. It's different. It's Eastern mentality. It's India. It's no waste. It's recycling, repurposing. They know how to do it. Believe me, we could learn a lot from them. Anyway, being prosperous, happy with what we have, utilizing what we have. A lot of words around that. So I'm sorry about that. But let's go into this word, salam, this sacred vibration, Ya Salam, O divine peace, the one who's wholesome, the one that gives tranquility, the one that's friendly, the one that's complete and sound and healthy and secure and well. So there's so many layers to Salam that maybe we didn't even know about before, but now we can experience them. So again, we'll do the short version. A 33, which is 11 and 11, 11, aloud, whisper, and silently. And if you just want to repeat it as a mantra, peace, 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 that's okay too for yourself. Emphasis on lam. Put the lips together. So, salam. If you put them together, you won't get it from the word just peace, but you'll feel a vibration happening in your body. It opens up to the sound code. Ya salam. 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 Now breathing in and out, salam on the whisper. silently feeling those qualities coming into our being on the waves of that vibration. Yeah, Simone. The prayer that we say in the evening and we close our classes with is called Khatum. Murshid said of this prayer that each line is a living metaphysical reality. And so I'd like to do this prayer using the breath, breathing in and out. But before we do the practice, and I'll guide us what phrases we breathe in and out on. In the study guide, italics is always breathing out. So, and it says that in the study guide online. But I want to talk about each line. So if you'll allow me to do a little bit of commentary, and then we'll do the practice together, and then we'll close our circle. So, and I will say, it'll be too long for you to hold the breath, but I will say on the out breath, we're going to breathe, O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. So, with that, we are reaching out. We're giving supplication. We're bowing to the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. Out of love, there is born the wish to be harmonious. And out of harmony is born beauty. And then we'll breathe in the Lord of heaven and earth. Breathing in love, harmony, and beauty, and acknowledging that vibration existing on both heaven and earth. Bringing that into our being. And then we say, as if we're opening the chambers of the heart, open our hearts. That we may hear thy voice, that voice of knowledge, the voice of the soul. We're breathing out, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice. And we breathe in, which constantly cometh from within. It's there, albeit hidden, lifting the veil. And then the next line is breathing out, disclose to us thy divine light. And then we'll breathe in. That divine light which exists in everything, always, everywhere. Do we have the eyes, the spiritual eyes to see it? See it, recognize it. It's like in India, bowing, namaste, I honor the divine light within you. So disclose to us thy divine light and bringing it in, which is hidden in our souls. There, it's hidden. It's renting the veils, clearing the obscuration so that we can live from that divine light within. And then we'll breathe out that we may know and understand life better, not confused or deluded by the outward appearance of things, and also having the patience to wait for the knowledge to come to us because sometimes it takes some time. Which is hidden in our souls and breathing out, that we may know and understand life better. And breathing in, most merciful and compassionate God, may that mercy and compassion be birthed within us. God, give us that. Then breathing out, give us thy great goodness. Thy great goodness, not my great goodness, thy great goodness. Give us thy great goodness. And breathing in, teach us thy loving forgiveness, reconciling those things that may be irreconcilable. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. and raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Mershit put the word men at the end, men, which divide men, meaning humanity. You know, we could say raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide humanity. We are all flesh and blood. We all are born. We all live. We all love. And we all die. That supersedes anything else. We are the same in this experience of humanity. It doesn't have race, it doesn't have religion, it doesn't have creed, it doesn't have national boundaries. It's called humanity, the one life. I heard that song. I was doing exercise this morning. It's a dance exercise. And it was one love, one life. Let's get together. It will be all right. It's beautiful words. That's it. And then we breathe in. Send us the peace of thy divine spirit, thy divine spirit, which is hidden in our souls. And then unite us all in thy perfect being. Amen. Amen. Shall we try it? I'll tell us we're gonna begin the first line of the prayer, and I'll say it aloud, and you can just work with it on your breath. Take a deep breath in and breathe out. O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, breathe in. The Lord of heaven and earth, breathe out. Open our hearts that we may hear thy voice. Breathe in, which constantly cometh from within. Breathe out. Disclose to us thy divine light, in which is hidden in our souls. Out, that we may know and understand life better. In, most merciful and compassionate God. Out, give us thy great goodness. In, teach us thy loving forgiveness. Out, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divides men, humanity, peoples. Breathing in, send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and out, and unite us all in thy perfect being, and in Amen. Yeah, as we come upon the holidays, some of us may have a lot of family that we're spending time with, and some of us may be alone. But I want to give you something to think about should you be alone, because I found this phrase a while ago while I was studying for another class, and I thought this is perfect for this time of year. It's very beautiful. And when I feel alone or lonely, I think of this. It's been very inspirational for me. And it says, whenever, this is by Jalaluddin Rumi, whenever you're alone, whenever you're alone, remind yourself that God has sent everyone else away so that there's only you and God. God has sent everyone else away. So there is only you and God. So have some comfort in that and spend some time with the divine being. Welcome them, it, her, him, into your heart. Take comfort in that communion. So I'd like to dedicate the merit of this time together, and I pray that there's some wholesomeness that has arisen, and may that spread in ever-widening circles, even into other areas of our universe and beyond, to touch every living thing so that every little living thing can have peace and equanimity and life and light and love in their lives. Even in the tragedies of war, famine, thirsting, being lost, may people hear that voice which constantly cometh from within and find comfort and true peace. Ya Salaam. Now, I have a little PSA to give, public service announcement. You know, it's the end of the year, and I know that all of you are so generous throughout the year. And yet this year I've done so many classes for other groups. And while I'm doing them, they don't offer anything to the Sufi message, so that keeping this boat afloat is kind of dependent upon me and your kind generosity. So I know some of you give on a monthly basis. I'm not asking for more, but if you want to give a little bit more, that's okay, because we do have these expenses of especially the technology that connects us. And I would hope that in your gifting, I might gather a little bit of money to send to the Hope Project in India in our names as a group. And the Hope Project, as you know, is in the poorest area of New Delhi, and it's by the resting place of our Murshid, Inayat Khan. And that place teaches women handicrafts so they can earn money. It gives food to children. It helps with education. It gives a safe haven for very poor people. They also feed the poor. So if we could increase our merit as a group, as an association, as a group of friends, I promise that I will do that in our name, and then also pay the bills to keep the lights on, so to speak. So I send you my love and good wishes for the most blessed and brilliant, loving, warm holiday. And may your new year be blessed with good health and happiness and an abundance of all good things. And I want you all to know from the bottom of my heart how much I appreciate you and love you, and I'm so grateful for all of you in my life.